Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hey everyone, welcome to an anthology episode where I answer any question that you have about history, and I pack four of these Q&A segments into one. This episode is sort of themed around presidents, but not exactly. Two of the questions have to do directly with presidents. One is, how long have foreign nations tried to meddle in U.S. presidential elections? And this has been a big question since the 2016 election. Then I talk about presidential death threats and assassination attempts from George Washington all the way up to Obama. The third question is sort of about presidents, is how exactly did the Soviet Union end? Talk about all the U.S. presidents and foreign policies that dealt with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. The last question really doesn't have to do with presidents. It's why did so many Nazis flee to Argentina after World War II? But hey, I'll just throw it in because it's an interesting question. Okay, so I'll separate out each of these questions with the GarageBand sound effect, the booming rumble. So when you hear that sound, you know we're going from one question to the other. And as I like to always mention, if you ever want to submit a question to me like this, I'll be glad to consider it. You can send me an email at info@historyonthenet.com, or you can send me a voicemail, as you'll hear on this episode, by going to historyunplugpodcast.com. Take it away, booming rumble. Hey everyone, welcome to an in-between-isode where I answer any question that you have about history. Today's question comes from Genevieve about meddling in politics. Take it away, Genevieve.
I've been surprised that more people from both parties are not aghast by Russian meddling in our election. Is this because we have a rich history of others meddling in our elections, of which I am unaware? Historically, when have other countries tried to influence our elections, and how was this done before the age of the internet? I know we have a rich history of meddling in others' elections ourselves.
That's a very timely question. That's all over the news right now about Russian meddling in America's 2016 presidential election. Has it happened before? Absolutely. Politicians throughout history love to try to influence the outcome of an election, especially if it's in a nation or a state that's not their own. People have done it to America many times. We've done it, and we'll probably continue to do so as long as politics remains the nasty blood sport that it is, basically until the singularity or the rapture or whatever eschaton you choose that will make humanity fundamentally different than it already is. Now let's go back. Meddling in American politics is something that the Founding Fathers were well aware of, and you can find this worry all over the Federalist Papers and documents the framers of the Constitution wrote. Yeah, they couldn't have imagined cybercrime, but there were plenty of other ways that they can envision foreign powers trying to meddle in American politics. Matt Vega wrote a paper on this very subject in a Loyola of Los Angeles Law Review paper. He notes that at the time the U.S. was a brand new nation and its republic was an unproven system of government. Europe was full of examples of this time, off the heels of the Thirty Years' War, where powerful princes are jockeying for power and trying to influence weaker nations and playing them off one another. This is still when you have the Holy Roman Empire, Germany is fractured in a bunch of small principalities and duchies, and there's constant jockeying and trying to influence a weaker neighbor to play him off against a stronger neighbor. So they figured, why wouldn't European states try to do the same to a young United States? Very reasonable. So this is a major reason that you have constitutional features like the Emoluments Clause, which prevents bribery, or at least attempts to prevent bribery. James Madison cited examples from ancient times as well as 18th century examples in Europe of the widespread nature of attempts at bribery. The Federalist 68, which was probably written by Alexander Hamilton, describes the corruption that comes from, quote, the desire in foreign powers to gain an improper ascendant in our councils as one of the most deadly adversaries of Republican government. Well, of course, they were right. We can see foreign meddling in the election of 1796. This is after George Washington leaves office, and the first two parties, the Federalists and the Republicans, emerge, and politics starts to get nasty. With the progress of the French Revolution, which led to war between Great Britain and France in 1793, Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson thought that the U.S. should support France, who helped it during the Revolutionary War. But Washington sided with his pro-British Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, and others thought that the U.S. should be neutral in the battle. He sent pro-British Chief Justice John Jay to negotiate a treaty with Great Britain to preserve good relations between the two countries. This led to the Jay Treaty, which was ratified in 1795, and it enraged the French government, who thought that it was a violation of the 1778 alliance between France and the United States. France decided to take action because it thought that American public opinion was on its side, and it wanted to replace the pro-British Federalist Washington with the pro-French Republican Thomas Jefferson. The French ambassador began openly supporting the Republicans and attacking Federalists whenever they could. Washington announced he wouldn't seek a third term as president in 1796. In his farewell address, he includes a warning against foreign entanglements. But this message was specifically aimed at the time at France's ongoing efforts to influence the election in Washington. France just stepped up those efforts, and in October and November, the French diplomat, he released notes to be printed in a Philadelphia newspaper calling on Americans to reject the Jay Treaty and renew the alliance with France. Now, we don't have a lot of evidence that the French diplomat's attempts to get Jefferson elected actually made it happen. And in fact, a lot of people think that it hurt the Republicans, making them seem like pawns of a foreign government, which men who were fresh off fighting the Revolutionary War wouldn't have liked very much. James Madison wrote to Thomas Jefferson in December 1796, before the electors cast their ballots, that the French scheme was working all the evil with which it is pregnant and threatened to create a perpetual alienation of France and the United States. John Adams won that election. Jefferson became vice president, and it was a pretty bitterly divided administration. These fears of foreign meddling continue in the United States well after the founding era. In 1938, Congress passed the Foreign Agents Registration Act, or FARA, which was a, according to the Department of Justice, a response to the large number of German propaganda agents in the pre-World War II U.S. The law required foreign agents to disclose certain involvement in U.S. politics. Specifically, it required any informational material they produced to be labeled clearly as coming from a foreign source. FARA was produced in an age of corruption and increasing fear of foreign agents, and the House Un-American Activities Committee is established right around the same time. Its goal was to make sure that if ideas were introduced into American political discourse by outside sources, then citizens know exactly where the information is coming from. In the 60s, we have another example of a presidential nominee benefiting from foreign interference. This is in 1968 when Richard Nixon is running against Hubert Humphrey, and the person helping him is South Vietnam. Hubert Humphrey wasn't able to disassociate himself from President Lyndon Johnson's unpopular war policy in Vietnam. Humphrey's only hope was to break with Johnson and reverse course on Vietnam. On September 30th, 1968, he announced that upon taking office, he would unilaterally halt the bombing of North Vietnamese targets and thus take a risk for peace. Nixon's lead then shrank. And then President Johnson announced an October surprise that the U.S. had agreed to peace talks with North Vietnam and that Hanoi would agree to stop bombing South Vietnamese cities in return for a halt in America's bombing campaign north of the demilitarized zone. But Nixon had his own surprise. He was using back channels to scuttle the Johnson administration's negotiations with the different parties in Vietnam. His team met with different South Vietnamese officials and informed them that Nixon would secure a better deal for his country than either Humphrey or Johnson, and that the Democrats were effectively prepared to sell out Saigon to secure peace at any price. Turns out that Johnson and Humphrey knew about what Nixon was doing. Johnson regarded Nixon's willful interference as treason, and it appears to be a violation of the Logan Act, which prohibits individuals from negotiating with foreign governments. But they didn't have a smoking gun, so they couldn't go public with it. Well, the October surprise ended up working. The government of South Vietnam announced that it would not be able to participate in the peace talks and broke away from them almost as soon as LBJ announced them. So Nixon was able to ride the wave into the White House, and we don't know if it was decisive, but we can argue that it was effective because it was a close race between Nixon and Humphrey. Now, America has done this as well, too, many times, and I'll just give a few examples. One is attempts to influence the Argentine election in 1946. The U.S. didn't want Juan Perón to be reelected. He had fascist tendencies, and he allowed Nazi members to enter Argentina and relocate there. And I've done a podcast episode about Nazis who entered Argentina due to what were called rat lines opened up by Juan Perón. The U.S. released a 130-page document called the Blue Book on Argentina. It accused Juan Perón of complicity with the Nazis, and the government had a secret plan to inaugurate the Fourth Reich. Now, Juan Perón didn't go nearly that far in his support of Nazism. Argentines actually found out what the U.S. was up to, and it backfired and only cemented support for Juan Perón. I'll just give one other example, and this is from the Philippines. In 1953, CIA chief Alan Dulles offered his best agents $5 million to swing the Philippines' 1953 presidential election. The agent, Edward Lansdale, bragged that he used only about $50,000 to get candidate Ramon Magsaysay elected. He basically ran Magsaysay's campaign. When the candidate tried to give a speech written by a Filipino colleague rather than a CIA handler, Lansdale punched him hard enough to knock the presidential candidate out. Turns out Magsaysay was elected with a landslide victory, and he was considered to be the Eisenhower of the Pacific. Well, there you go. As you can see, 2016 is not the first example of foreign governments trying to meddle in American elections or vice versa. Today's question is this. Can you tell me about the history of death threats against American presidents? Well, I have a lot to choose from for this question. And I actually interviewed a guest on this very topic. His name is Mel Eitan, and he wrote a book called Hunting the Presidents, Threats, Plots, and Assassination Attempts from FDR to Obama. Now, the book title makes it sound like assassination threats only occurred during this time, but that is not the case at all. And Mel notes that. The point he makes is that the threats against president really accelerate during this time period because with modern media, with radio, then television, the president is more in the public eye. He's attracting the attention of more people. He becomes personalized in a way that he wasn't in the past when the president would just make statements in a newspaper. And unless you were in a major city, you would probably never see him in his lifetime. But being able to see or hear a president can attract the attention of the masses, and those who suffer from mental illness might fixate upon him. So that's why you get a lot more threats against him. But threats against the president go all the way back to George Washington. They accelerate in the 20th century with the advent of not just media, like I mentioned, but a fast universal postal system, making threatening letters more likely to arrive at their intended recipient. And personal explosives and small firearms give any U.S. resident access to a lethal weapon. By the time Harry Truman took office, threats against the president were occurring on an industrial scale. The Secret Service had 50,000-odd records in their files of people who had written threatening or obscene letters to the president or his family, or had turned up at the White House. The Secret Service refused to be drawn on details, but told reporters that would-be assassins were hustled to St. Elizabeth's Mental Hospital. Almost 90% of the people on the threats list were described as, well, crackpots. Agents said some threateners had pocketed guns and tried to enter the White House. In the period 1949 to 1950, the Secret Service investigated 1,925 threats against Truman's life. In the first year of the Korean War, arrests and detentions doubled. In the last year of the Truman administration, the president received more than 3,000 threats. According to Agent Floyd M. Boring, the Secret Service referred abusive letters to field officers. He said, sometimes the guy was arrested if he made a threat. And of course, they actually had a copy of the letter right with them. Some of these people were just voluminous writers. Boring said most of them were psychotics. Talking to the threatener usually did the job, Boring said, and field officers would tell them, we don't mind if you talk to the president or write to him or disagree with him, but you can't become abusive. You can't call him a son of a bitch or whatever. So here are some examples of non-serious threats against the president, and then I'll give some examples of serious threats. And I'll use the example of Truman, just because there are so many threats against presidents that I could practically devote an entire podcast to this, and Secret Service records really start to accumulate in the Truman administration, so we have good archives from his period. Most of the verbal and written threats Truman received were thought to be non-serious, the result of drunken or inappropriate remarks spoken at the wrong time and in the wrong place. In December 1950, President Truman attended the Army-Navy football game in Philadelphia. Fans Adolf Rusiek and Michael Pantakuski had traveled from their homes in Lackawanna, New York. As the president's train pulled into the station, an alert police officer heard one of the men say, if I had a gun, I would have bumped him off. The men were arrested and taken to police headquarters for questioning. After an hour, agents decided the men had simply made foolish remarks and were just a couple of punks blown off. Rusiek and Pantakuski were taken to a stadium to watch the rest of the football game. Rusiek said he had made the remark, but was just making a wisecrack to point out it appeared to him the president was not well protected. Typical of non-serious written threats Truman received was the case of a Kansan woman married to a tenant farmer. 45-year-old Mary Louise Jones, a self-confessed communist sympathizer, sent 5 letters and 4 postcards to Truman in 1952, using, quote, obscene, abusive, and defamatory language and making threats to inflict bodily harm on the president of the United States. A postcard dated January 14th contained the sentence, I hope someone kills you. In a letter dated January 19th, she wrote, I just want to tell you, Harry, I'd rather be a slave of the Kremlin than a slave of big business, big landholders, and big city racketeers. She was arrested by federal agents. When she was charged, she described them as Truman's Gestapo. Another typical letter writer who threatened Truman was Robert T. Galditz, a 22-year-old student and attended Ohio State University. He was a research fellow in chemical engineering and worked at the university's engineering experiment station. He was described by a colleague as a quiet sort of fellow who doesn't use profanity. In April 1951, Galditz sent President Truman 2 letters. One of the letters was addressed to that jackass in the White House. The letter read, you, expletive, this stupid bungle of kicking General Douglas MacArthur out should entitle you to the electric chair. However, if that is not done by Congress, you may be sure I will take it upon myself to see that your head is blown off with a high-powered rifle if you ever stick your nose in Columbus. How could I serve my country better? After a post office employee noticed obscene words on the envelopes, he informed the Secret Service, and Godlitz was arrested and charged. Now here's one last example of a serious threat against the president. And again, if you want me to talk about specific threats against specific presidents, you can always contact me. You can contact me at info@historyonthenet.com or go to historyunpluggedpodcast.com and I can go into more detail. But let me just give another Truman example here. President Truman was a subject of numerous threats by former military men who had received dishonorable discharge. One threatener, Dennis Porter, was a slightly built 20-year-old ex-U.S. Marine with a crew cut who came from Herman, Louisiana. He'd been dishonorably discharged from the Marines when they discovered he had a criminal record. He said, they threw me out after telling me I wasn't much good. After he was arrested and imprisoned in Franklinton, Louisiana for defamation of character, he wrote to President Truman and threatened his life. The letter was mailed on October 28, 1948, a week before Truman's re-election. His letter stated, I'll write you a few lines to let you know what I think of your rotten political schemes. It is a shame and disgrace for anyone to treat the American people like you do. Even if you win the office of president, you won't live to glorify in it. If God gives me the strength, you won't be president long. I'll see to that. And him being ex-military could put a lot more threat behind his words than other people who are just blowing off steam or might have ideological reasons to go after the president.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word UNPLUG to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word UNPLUG to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word UNPLUG to 30605 and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text UNPLUG to 30605. I'd like to tell you about a new podcast series called King's Last March. April 4th, 2018 marks 50 years since Martin Luther King Jr.'s death, and he remains a vivid symbol of hope for racial equality in America. But his politics were much more complex and radical than most people realize. King's Last March is a podcast series from American Public Media that tells a lesser-known story of the last year of King's life, when he fought to broaden the civil rights movement despite immense pressure to back down. You'll hear about the causes he championed, the threats and controversies he faced, and the lasting legacies of his assassination. Subscribe to King's Last March on Apple Podcasts or at apmpodcasts.org. Today's question comes from Mark and Kara McMorrow. The question is, why did so many of the Nazi leaders flee to Argentina after World War II? I always assumed it was due to extradition laws, but I began to think it doesn't make sense being the only reason. Well, thank you for the question. Yeah, extradition laws, I always see those appear in movies about bank robbers who want to flee the United States, or in the show Prison Break where they go to Panama because they figures, oh, I can take my millions of dollars and openly flaunt my wealth, and there's nothing the U.S. can do about it because there's no extradition treaty in place. Now, that alone would not enable a Nazi to waltz into a South American country. Nazis were amongst the most wanted people on Earth for their war crimes, and that alone wouldn't prevent them from being captured or killed, as we'll see here in a little bit. Okay, why did Nazis go to South America and Argentina in particular? It has to do with a term, rat lines. Why rat lines? As you know, rats will flee a sinking ship, and that's what we understand there, that there was a pathway for certain Nazi leaders to escape Nazi Germany when it became clear that the war effort was turning against the Nazis by 1943, definitely by 1944, and it was only a matter of time. Now, sadly, the origin of Nazi rat lines has to do with some good intentions. The origins of the first rat lines are connected to Vatican-Argentine relations before and during World War II. As early as 1942, Monsignor Luigi Maglioni contacted Ambassador Lobet and inquired the willingness of the government of the Argentine Republic to apply its immigration law generously in order to encourage, at the opportune moment, European Catholic immigrants to seek the necessary land and capital in our country. They wanted to lay a groundwork for future Catholic immigration to Argentina. However, there were actually priests and bishops who were sympathetic to Nazis and German POWs. Bishop Alois Hudal was a Nazi sympathizer and rector of the Pontifico Istituto Teutonico Santa Maria della Amina in Rome, a seminary for Austrian and German priests, and spiritual director of the German people resident in Italy. After the end of the war in Italy, Hudal became active in ministering to German-speaking prisoners of war. Hudal used his position to aid in the escape of wanted Nazi war criminals, and this is a fact that he was unashamedly open about later. Some of these wanted men were being held in internment camps, generally without identity papers, and they would be enrolled in camp registers under false names. Hudal mentions in his memoirs why he thought this was okay. He said of his actions, "I thank God that he allowed me to visit and comfort many victims in their prisons and concentration camps and to help them escape with false identity papers." He explained that the Allies' war against Germany was not a crusade, but the rivalry of economic complexes for whose victory they had been fighting. The so-called business, using catchwords like democracy, race, religious liberty, and Christianity as bait for the masses. All these experiences were the reason why I felt duty-bound after 1945 to devote my whole charitable work mainly to former national socialists and fascists, especially to so-called war criminals. You can definitely argue that his actions were terrible, but in Hudal's perspective, he thought that there were German soldiers and even officers who were caught up in a non-ideological war. Whether you think that's true for high-ranking Nazi officials, well, tough argument to make. Now, that was one side of the Ratline exchange, but of course, Argentina had to be on the receiving end willingly, and it was because of Argentine President Juan Perón. Juan Perón secretly ordered diplomats and intelligence officers to establish escape routes through ports in Spain and Italy to smuggle thousands of former SS officers and Nazi Party members out of Europe. A high-ranking SS officer or Nazi Party member that would probably be on trial at the Nuremberg trials couldn't just easily covertly waltz into South America. Perón had been drawn to the ideologies of Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler, as with numerous other fascist-leaning South American leaders, while he was serving as a military attaché in Italy during the years prior to World War II and the early years of World War II. He also sought to recruit those Nazis with particular military and technical expertise that he thought could help his country. So this is how Nazi party members and SS officers arrive in Argentina. Now, what happens after they arrive? One famous incident is in 1960, where Ricardo Clement stepped off a bus after finishing a shift as an assembly line foreman at a Mercedes-Benz automotive plant. As he was walking to a small brick house in a middle-class Buenos Aires suburb, he passed a chauffeur and two men working under the open hood of a black limousine. Suddenly, Clement was grabbed by the men and hauled kicking and screaming into the back of the vehicle. Well, Clement was actually Adolf Eichmann, the notorious Nazi SS lieutenant colonel, who masterminded the transport of European Jews to concentration camps. The men with the limousine were Israeli Secret Service agents. Eichmann was not alone. There were as many as 9,000 Nazi officers and collaborators who found sanctuary in South American countries. About 1,500 were in Brazil, about 500 to 1,000 in Chile, but 5,000 in Argentina. Now, it wasn't just sympathy to fascism that allowed all of these Nazis to come to Argentina. There were hundreds of thousands of German immigrants who lived in the country and had arrived as immigrants since the early 20th century. Argentina maintained close ties with Germany and remained neutral for much of World War II, and it also collaborated with the Catholic Church to receive them. I mentioned one bishop in the Catholic Church, but another one who helped this exchange on the European side was a French member of the Catholic Church that South America would be willing to receive Nazi collaborators from France who faced potential war crimes prosecution. So that spring, French war criminals carrying passports issued by the International Red Cross, stamped with Argentine tourist visas, began to cross the Atlantic Ocean. Numerous Vatican officials unwittingly aided in the escape of Nazi war criminals in their attempts to aid Catholic refugees amid the post-war rise of communist regimes across Europe. Now, a lot of the Nazis who escaped to South America were never brought to justice. Eichmann was, but one who wasn't was SS Colonel Walter Rauf, who created the mobile gas chambers that killed at least 100,000 people. He died in Chile in 1984. Gustav Wagner, an SS officer known as the Beast, died in Brazil in 1980 after the country's Supreme Federal Court refused to extradite him to Germany because of inaccuracies in their paperwork. Now, there's one Alpine town that held a particularly large number of Nazis, and forgive my pronunciation if I mess it up, which I probably will, Bariloche, which is located in the foothills of the Andes, and it's attracted German immigrants for 100 years. So it makes sense that a lot of these fleeing Nazi members would go to this town in order to blend in. According to historian Hermann Ruder, some of these former Nazis were not so secret about their continuing admiration of the Third Reich. According to him, Bariloche was a place where they recreated Berchtesgaden, sites of Hitler's holiday home. The old Nazis would celebrate, often not so secretly, all the high days of Nazism there. Hitler's birthday, the founding of the Third Reich, numerous other anniversaries. Now, there are conspiracy theories that Hitler himself was able to make it to this town, but there's no evidence about that, and there's every historical reason to assume that he died in his bunker in Berlin in 1945. Now, it should be noted that the United States is not innocent in this whole matter. There are some cases where the U.S. was complicit in the exodus of Nazi war criminals to South America. After the war, the U.S. Counterintelligence Corps recruited Klaus Barbie, the Gestapo chief of Lyon, France, who caused the death of thousands of French Jews and members of the French Resistance, as an agent to assist with anti-communist efforts. He was smuggled to Bolivia, where he continued his spy work and instructed the military regime how to torture and interrogate political opponents. He was finally extradited in 1983 and sentenced to life in prison after his conviction for crimes against humanity. And of course, I have to mention Operation Paperclip. These aren't SS officers, but the U.S., of course, was happy to welcome Germans who could be useful following World War II for the war effort. This was a secret program of the Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency, where more than 1,600 German scientists, engineers, and technicians, most famously Wernher von Braun, who built the V-2 rocket, were recruited for U.S. government employment between 1945 and 1959. Wernher von Braun was the chief scientist for the Apollo program. America welcomed these scientists because they were on the cutting edge of research of rocketry, and America wanted a military advantage with the Cold War coming on and the space race. And it overwhelmingly looks like they provided it, with America winning the space race, putting the first man on the moon in 1969. Now, you could call Operation Paperclip the gentleman's rat line, where these scientists didn't have to sneak out in the cover of darkness the way the SS officers did as well, but the idea is similar, and you can see how influential these could really be. Today's question is this: can you explain to me the fall of the Soviet Union? Sure, I'd be glad to. And a book that I recommend that helped me figure this out is a book called A Brief History of the Cold War by Lee Edwards and Elizabeth Edwards Spalding. This is a good book to give a flyover view of all the major events of the Cold War, from the realignment of the international order following World War II, the U.S. doctrine of containment, and different presidential administrations' approach to the Cold War, from Eisenhower to Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, all the way down through Reagan, and then Bush 41. Okay, so here's an outline of the fall of the Soviet Union. This was a decades-in-the-making outcome of Cold War politics, but it happened quite suddenly in the late 80s and early 90s. Different presidents sought the end of the Soviet Union. Others sought accommodation in the two great powers living in peace with one another, such as the Carter administration. But anyway, the fall of the Soviet Union happened very fast in the late 80s and early 90s, primarily at the level of US and USSR politics. But even then, the end wasn't clear. The end of the Soviet Union shocked people, and it wasn't something that was a foregone conclusion, even in its very final years. The first of the three meetings between Bush 41 and Gorbachev didn't take place until December 1989 in Malta, where Bush emphasized the need for superpower cooperation, choosing to overlook that the Soviet Union was no longer a superpower by any reasonable criteria, and that Marxism-Leninism in Eastern Europe was headed for Reagan's ash heap of history. The second summit was in May 1990 in Washington, D.C., where the emphasis was on economics. Gorbachev arrived in a somber mood, conscious that his country's economy was nearing free fall and nationalist pressures were splitting the Soviet Union. He was a virtual pariah at home, but the Soviet leader was greeted by large, friendly American crowds. Bush tried to help, granting most favored nation trading status to the Soviet Union. Gorbachev appealed to American businessmen to start new enterprises in the USSR, even though Soviet citizens couldn't really afford to buy that many American products at the time. In Moscow, the breadline stretched around the block. A month later, NATO issued a sweeping statement calling the London Declaration, proclaiming the Cold War was over and that Europe had entered a new promising era. But the Soviet Union still stood at this point, even though it was teetering. The shrinking Soviet Union received another major blow when the biggest republic, Russia, elected its own president, Boris Yeltsin. He was a former Politburo member turned militant anti-communist and announced his intention to abolish the Communist Party, dismantle the Soviet Union, and declare Russia to be an independent democratic capitalist state. For the remaining Stalinists in the Politburo, this was the final unacceptable act. Barely 3 weeks after the Bush-Gorbachev summit in Moscow, the head of the KGB, the Soviet Defense and Interior Ministers, and other hardliners, the so-called Gang of Eight, launched a coup. They placed Gorbachev under house arrest while he was vacationing in the Crimea, proclaiming a state of emergency and themselves the new leaders of the Soviet Union. They called in tanks and troops from outlying areas and ordered them to surround the Russian parliament where Yeltsin had his office. 8 decades earlier, Lenin had stood on a tank to announce the coming of Soviet communism. Now Yeltsin proclaimed its end by climbing onto a tank outside the parliament and declaring that the coup was unconstitutional. He urged all Russians to follow the law of the legitimate government of Russia. Within minutes, the Russian defense minister stated that not a hand will be raised against the people or the duly elected president of Russia. A Russian officer responded, "We are not going to shoot the president of Russia." So the image of Yeltsin confronting the Gang of Eight was flashed around the world by the Western television networks, especially on CNN, and none of whose telecasts were blocked by the coup plotters. The pictures convinced President Bush, who was on vacation in Maine at the time, and other Western leaders to condemn the coup and praise Yeltsin and other resistance leaders. The attempted coup, called the Vodka Putsch because of the inebriated state of a coup leader at a televised news conference, collapsed after only 3 days. When Gorbachev returned to Moscow, he found that Boris Yeltsin was in charge. Most of the organs of power of the Soviet Union had effectively ceased to exist or had been transferred to the Russian government. Gorbachev tried to act as if nothing had changed and announced, for example, that there was a need to renew the Communist Party. And, well, he was ignored. The people clearly wanted an end to the party and him. He was the first Soviet leader to be derided at the annual May Day parade when protesters atop Lenin's tomb in Red Square displayed banners reading, "Down with Gorbachev, down with socialism and the fascist Red Empire, down with Lenin's party." A supremely confident Yeltsin banned the Communist Party and transferred all Soviet agencies to the control of the Russian Republic. The Soviet republics of Ukraine and Georgia declared their independence. As the historian William H. Chafe writes, the Soviet Union had itself fallen victim to the same forces of nationalism, democracy, and anti-authoritarianism that had engulfed the rest of the Soviet Empire. President Bush at last accepted the inevitable, the unraveling of the Soviet Union. At a cabinet meeting on September 4th, he announced that the Soviets and all the republics would and should define their own future, and that we ought to resist the temptation to react to or comment on each development. "Clearly," he said, "the momentum is toward greater freedom. The last thing the United States should do is to make some statement or demand that would galvanize opposition among the Soviet hardliners." But opposition to the new non-communist Russia was thin or scattered, and most of the hardliners were either in jail or exile. On December 12th, Secretary of State James Baker, borrowing liberally from the rhetoric of Ronald Reagan, delivered an address titled "America and the Collapse of the Soviet Empire." He said, "The state that Lenin founded and Stalin built held within itself the seeds of its demise. As a consequence of Soviet collapse, we live in a new world. We must take advantage of this new Russian revolution." Baker praised Gorbachev for helping to make the transformation possible, but he made it clear that the United States believed his time had passed. President Bush quickly sought to make Yeltsin an ally, beginning with the coalition he formed to conduct the Gulf War. Things weren't quite over for Gorbachev. A despondent Gorbachev, not quite sure why it all happened so quickly, officially resigned as president of the Soviet Union on Christmas Day 1991, 74 years after the Bolshevik Revolution. Casting about for reasons, he spoke of a totalitarian spirit that prevented the Soviet Union from becoming a prosperous and well-to-do country, but he didn't acknowledge the role of Lenin, Stalin, and other communist dictators in creating and sustaining that totalitarian system. He referred to the mad militarization that had crippled our economy, public attitudes, and morals, but accepted no blame for himself or the generals who had spent up to 40% of the Soviet budget on the military. He said that an end has been put to the Cold War, but admitted no role for any Western leader in ending the war. After 6 years, the unelected president of a non-existent country stepped down, still in denial. That night, the hammer and sickle came down from atop the Kremlin, replaced by the blue, white, and red flag of Russia. Adam Ulan notes that it's an irony of history that the claim of communism being a force for peace among the nations should finally be laid to rest in its birthplace. Looking back on America's longest war and the fall of the Soviet Union, Martin Malia writes, "The Cold War did not end because of the contestants reaching an agreement. It ended because the Soviet Union disappeared." When Gorbachev reached for the pen to sign the document officially terminating the USSR, he discovered it had no ink. He had to borrow a pen from the CNN television crew covering the event. Gorbachev eventually earned the Nobel Peace Prize for allowing the Soviet Union to dissolve without using brute force. Many analysts feared that the Soviet Union, crumbling apart with breakaway republics, in a last final gasp, the Soviet Union would launch military attacks to forcibly bring them back in line, and there would be bloody clashes with soldiers and rebels, and some of the strongest hardliners were in the military, so this was very plausible. So there was very little that was dramatic about the dissolution of the Soviet Empire. It ended with somebody who had no ink in his pen, but in some ways it turned out as well as anyone could have hoped for. Well, thank you so much for the question. If any of you have one for me, you can contact me by emailing me at info@historyonthenet.com, or you can send me a voicemail on SpeakPipe. This is software that makes it very easy to record an audio question. You just basically click on a website and it will record from your computer. And you can have your voice broadcast on the internet. And you can find out how to do that by going to historyunplugpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site, historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.
The history of the popes of Rome and Christianity reaches into nearly every aspect of history. In the History of the Papacy podcast, we step over the rope. We dive in to discover more about the people, events, and background that define the influence of the popes of Rome and church, not only on the West, but the world. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search for History of the Papacy on your favorite podcast platform.